From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Iran's death toll from the coronavirus could rise into the millions, warned government officials this week, as a massive jump in fatalities was observed. The hardest hit nation in the Arab and Muslim world, Iran has so far lost nearly 1,000 lives and documented more than 16,000 confirmed cases of infection from COVID-19. But in addition to contending with an unknown and terrifyingly infectious disease, Iranian authorities are struggling to marshal the necessary medical resources in the face of draconian sanctions by the US and Europe. Across the world, in Venezuela, a similar situation with sanctions is transpiring. My guest is Vijay Prashad. He is the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and a writing fellow and chief correspondent for Globetrotter, a project of the Independent Media Institute. He's the author of well over a dozen books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. Welcome to the program, Vijay.
Thanks a lot, Sonali.
So first, why has Iran been so deeply affected by the coronavirus, more so than other nations in the Muslim and Arab world?
I mean, it's hard to say. You know, it's very difficult. We don't have a clear etiology of this virus yet. It's hard to say why, for instance, the rate of infection has not been as high in India, why it's not been as high in Pakistan. You know, some people are saying, for instance, well, it's because of the Iran-China trade. But the China-Pakistan trade is as robust, and yet there haven't been the cases reported in Pakistan. It's very complicated to track an epidemic or pandemic of this kind. So I'm not sure exactly why there are so many cases in Iran. Certainly the Iranians have been struck very hard by this pandemic, and they're struggling to contain it.
I'm wondering if Iran is just testing more than nations like India and Pakistan. On Tuesday, there were reports that health officials were quite concerned in India because the requirements for those who can get a test were so high that they might just be missing a lot of people, which is, of course, deeply worrying and slightly tangential to our conversation. But I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, this is, of course, true. In Iran, the government says they've tested about 15 million people. That's an enormous number of people. It's not clear if they've tested them all, you know, with the proper COVID-19 test, or if they're including temperature checks and so on. But nonetheless, this is what they've been doing. They've been going in some areas door to door and trying to get at least the best understanding of how the spread is happening. In India, on the other hand, the testing has been anemic, and there have been some reported deaths. You know, in Calcutta, I'm told that there were perhaps 2 deaths today and so on. But the government hasn't said anything, and I'm not even sure why this is so. In Pakistan and India, you're not seeing the government response, you know, in any vigorous way, apart from the sort of personalization, you know, wash your hands, maintain social distance, and so on. Doesn't look like there's more happening. And I just want to say, Sonali, just for emphasis, that 100 years ago, when the so-called Spanish flu or the influenza epidemic took place, 60% of the people who died in that epidemic were in India. India, because of malnutrition, the people are extraordinarily susceptible to any kind of viral epidemic like this. So, you know, I hope very much that the COVID-19 pandemic doesn't strike India very hard. If it does, I'm afraid the death toll will be extraordinarily high.
So let's continue our conversation on Iran. What are the sanctions that Iran faces from the US and from Europe that specifically target or that specifically make Iran's healthcare infrastructure more difficult?
Well, there are 3 things I think that are very important. Of course, the sanctions give an exception for medical equipment, medical supplies. Of course, that's the case. But that's not enough. You know, you can't just look at it like that. You can't just say medical equipment can enter the country. You have to ask 3 different questions. Number one, how is Iran supposed to pay for the medical equipment when Iran's entire financial system has been sanctioned and cut off from the rest of the world? So until there's relief to Iran's financial system, Iran cannot pay for any medical equipment. Secondly, there is an enormous burden on Iran because the sanctions basically target transportation systems. In other words, airlines, even cargo companies are unwilling to fly in equipment to Iran because of the sanctions. The World Health Organization had aircraft ready in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, ready to carry medical equipment, coronavirus tests and so on into Iran. But as the WHO official on the ground said, we had some flight difficulties. In other words, the sanctions didn't allow the planes to take off. At the end, the United Arab Emirates, understanding that this is a global emergency, allowed military planes to fly the supplies in. So the second issue is the transportation question. The third issue is that these sanctions are quite terrible because they target public infrastructure, anything that goes to the state. It has to be known that globally, public health or health that is afforded to the poor is typically not in the private sector, it's from the state sector. So when the sanctions specifically target the state, they are targeting the public health system, not allowing it to access medicines and so on. And this is putting an enormous burden on Iran. The financial sanctions, the transportation sanctions, and the sanctions against the state being able to procure goods to provide a robust public health system for the people.
The fact that the Iranian government has actually marshaled as many resources as it has is quite impressive. Even if the millions of tests that they carried out weren't all, you know, the official COVID test and temperature checks, that's still a pretty remarkable achievement, which is something that, unfortunately, U.S. officials rarely want to acknowledge. Are there lessons? I mean, and this applies to China as well. During the recent debate between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, there was criticism of China, even though Sanders wanted to suggest that or tried to suggest that if China has something to teach us about how to tackle this virus, shouldn't we listen?
Very unfortunate situation. I think people need to understand that in both Iran and China, state institutions haven't been eroded and destroyed. You know, in the West, there was this policy of neoliberalism or austerity, basically, long-standing, decades-long austerity, where the state institutions were run down. In the United States, the public health infrastructure has basically been underfunded since 2008 and, you know, in many cases, largely eroded. Now, what has happened is, ideologically, or in terms of how people understand these things, they think that, you know, the United States is a free country, and therefore any country where there's a robust state is authoritarian. This is the unfortunate cultural, defeat that a robust state idea has had in the United States. That people look at Iran, they look at China and say, these are authoritarian states. Now, of course, there may be elements of the state that one doesn't like. But in terms of state provision of certain social goods, health, education, and so on, these countries haven't eroded their state institutions. So those exist there. You know, Iran is being helped as well by the Chinese government, which has immediately shipped in supplies. They've broken all the embargoes. They say they don't care. This is a global pandemic. There should not be any sanctions. And they're quite right, of course. And also the Chinese have sent Chinese Red Cross officials who've met with Iranian Red Crescent. They've been sharing information and so on. But they still have a robust healthcare system, however underfunded, however eroded. You know, so the skills of people have been maintained, and they are the ones who are trying their best against all the odds. And I must say, it's an uphill task. You know, let nobody assume that the Iranians are going to be able to defeat COVID-19. The broadcaster who on Tuesday on Iranian state television said that there might be millions dead in Iran. He himself is a doctor and he knows what he's talking about. You know, he doesn't want to alarm people, but they should also not stop being vigilant. This is very important. A public health emergency is something that individuals, families, communities need to take as seriously as the institutions of the state.
I'm wondering what you make of media coverage of how Iran has tackled the situation. The New York Times made a big deal of publishing satellite photos showing mass graves that they say were to bury the bodies of those who have died from the coronavirus, and a subsequent government cover-up. But they're not covering the fact that sanctions by the U.S. are making it so much harder for Iran to respond.
I think that the media in the United States, particularly the corporate media, has lost its moral fiber. You know, in this case, for instance, they're not covering, as you say, the sanctions question, but there seems to be no humanity in the coverage in places like China, Iran, Iraq. Iraq struggling with COVID-19, I haven't seen one story. Meanwhile, the United States, in the middle of all this, decides to bomb Iraq. You know, right. I think there's a lack of moral fiber here. You've got to understand the human story here. You know, it's not about your prejudices and your, you know, anti-Iranian feelings and so on. The Imperial College London WHO study suggests that at the current rate of mitigation in the United States, there may be 1.5 million fatalities. You know, rather than poke fingers at Iran and mock the Iranian story right now, I think it's probably better for the US media to have a sense of humility and understand what's coming to the United States and have some compassion for the Iranian people as they're fighting against a very terrible virus.
And the paper you're referring to is the London research paper that seems to have been what might have changed the Trump administration's tone on this virus. And I believe what they said was that without mitigation in the UK and the Great Britain, they estimate more than 500,000 deaths. In the US, 2.2 million. That's without mitigation. Let's talk about Venezuela, where the U.S. has a similar attitude as it does toward Iran. President Nicolas Maduro still remaining in power, although the situation in Venezuela was dire before the virus hit. What has happened after the virus hit? Latin America so far hasn't been as hard hit as the Middle East, as Europe especially, but it's very likely in the beginning stages.
Well, I must say the Venezuelan people, you know, have been able to withstand sanctions. They've organized themselves. The commune system has come into effect before Corona and now subsequently. Across the city of Caracas, for instance, in 14 municipal markets, they've created a kind of disinfectant center so people can enter municipal markets and so on. It's not that they are just sitting down and doing nothing. They're preparing. They've had, I think, between 5 and 7 cases already. It's alarmed the government. And what the government there is able to do is turn to these sort of local authorities and let them, you know, loose, because these local authorities are controlled by people who live in the locality. You know, they have a vested interest in defending the people there. But of course, Venezuela is suffering deeply from the cuts, that they've had to make on their medical system because of the sanctions. These very criminal unilateral sanctions by the United States government have prevented them from using their own money, you know, some of it stolen by the Bank of London, to buy medical goods, bring it in, refurbish their hospitals, which have deteriorated, certainly because of the sanctions. And so what you've seen now is you've seen the WHO come in, the World Health Organization, helping Venezuela with equipment. You've seen the Cubans come in, you know, the remarkable Cubans who've right. sent their doctors to Italy, sent their doctors to Iran, and have now sent their doctors to Venezuela. You know, it's hats off to the Cubans. They don't seem to care that these are not Cuba. There's no Cuba first nationalism. You know, as Fidel Castro quite rightly said, Cuba is not a country, Cuba is the world.
I'm so glad you brought up Cuba. Also something that came up during the Democratic debate on Sunday, but it's a country that has maybe gotten accustomed, if you will, to living with decades and decades of a U.S. embargo up until just recently. And then, of course, under Trump, there's a threat of reversing all of the progress that was made during the Obama administration. But this is a country that has essentially learned self-reliance, right? And it's the Cuban doctor doctors are the marvel of the world. Bernie Sanders got into trouble for admiring the educational system of Cuba, but Cuban doctors have stepped up where doctors from industrialized nations haven't been able to in global disasters. And it seems as though they're doing the same during this coronavirus crisis. What can we learn? And Vijay, I'm sure you've seen this article by Farhad Manju recently in the New York Times. Everyone's a socialist in a pandemic. What can we learn from countries with robust government infrastructure, regardless of how the U.S. thinks of them, regardless of whether they might be fundamentalist governments or authoritarian governments, but just in terms of a robust social safety net, what can we learn from governments that have robustness, that are some that have the infrastructure people can rely on?
Well, you know, in a time of a pandemic, it's very clear that private medicine, private pharmaceutical companies, this is a disaster. This is no way to manage the health of people. You know, there's only one way to manage the health, and that's to socialize healthcare. There's no other way. I mean, in this case, for instance, it's ridiculous that private companies are out there individually trying to manufacture, you know, this antidote or the vaccine, and so that they can patent it, make money on it. This should be an open source project, a global project. The moment the vaccine comes out, it should be delivered for free around the world. There should be no money made, you know, to try and immunize people against this coronavirus. There are other coronaviruses. You know, it's ridiculous that vaccines are things that can be patented. Social wealth produces the knowledge to produce the vaccine. The vaccine, therefore, should be delivered socially. There's no other way to manage healthcare.
And I'm sure you saw the report that Trump tried to lure a vaccine development company from Germany for exclusive U.S. use. He later denied, or the White House denied that was the case. But there were government officials in Germany that claimed that this is what the U.S. was trying to do, which was just quite shocking.
You know, the moment the Chinese sequenced corona in Wuhan, they put it up on the net for free for anybody to look at. Because the point was, it's not about taking that knowledge and then privatizing the information. It's about having it in the commons, you know, creating a common kind of understanding of what the problem is, letting scientists take a crack at it together and coming up with a vaccine, coming up with tests and so on. That's got to be the attitude. You know, you have to have a socialist attitude towards medicine. You cannot have this ridiculous attitude about poaching, you know, development companies, trying to say it's only for Americans or something. That's such a narrow-minded, you know, immoral attitude towards a very serious crisis.
Vijay, have you seen that Spain has moved to nationalize all its private hospitals? Because after Italy, now Spain is the new European front, you know, the new front in the coronavirus disaster is Spain. So this is something that, you know, some nations in the West seem to be taking as a serious possible path.
Well, I very much hope that what the Spanish government has done is followed by other governments. And I also hope that the International Monetary Fund, which has pledged $1 trillion to countries that are going to be in distress, I hope that the IMF, when it looks at African countries, Latin American countries, Asian countries, encourages the countries where they themselves had sliced medical care. You know, it was by IMF diktat, pushed by the Europeans, pushed by the Americans, that healthcare around the world was sliced. I very much hope that the Spanish example now is held up to countries in the continents of the world so that they all start thinking seriously about renationalizing healthcare. And by the way, it's not just healthcare. The Italian government is renationalizing Alitalia. It's an excellent idea.
It seems as though when we are faced with a virus like this, the ideology of selfishness and capitalism are quite at odds with how the disease impacts us. Even though Trump has taken to calling it the Chinese virus, The virus does not discriminate. It doesn't matter where you're from. You are likely to get it based more on age than anything else, or show symptoms and, you know, be more at risk of dying from it based on age. You can still catch it if you're young. You can still pass it on. How important is it for those of us who have been for years on the progressive, in the progressive social movements in this country, to emphasize the values of solidarity and common good over the values of capitalism and selfishness, values that were really frighteningly on display with the reports of gun sales going up in recent days?
Well, a month ago, the WHO, the World Health Organization, put out a slogan, which I think is as important today as it was a month ago. And that slogan from the World Health Organization was solidarity, not stigma. I think it's very unfortunate that the American president decided to, you know, stigmatize a people, a country over what is indeed, a pandemic. It's a virus. It's got nothing to do with the place. Even the so-called Spanish flu was misnamed 100 years ago. The flu didn't originate in Spain in the first instance. And secondly, there was nothing Spanish about the flu. You know, when the first cholera came in 1817 to 1823, the French thought that because they're a democratic society, the cholera won't impact them. And they called it the Asiatic cholera. When that cholera entered France, it devastated the people. It killed a very large portion of the population of Paris. I think we should learn from the cholera. It was not Asiatic. It was a global pandemic. We should learn from the influenza epidemic. It was not Spanish. It was a global pandemic. This is certainly not a Chinese virus. It's a global pandemic. We need to have solidarity, not stigma.
It's felt so strange. I just want to share a personal experience. And Vijay, I don't know if you can share anything as well as in terms of how you're dealing with this crisis, but it felt so strange for me to be at the grocery store yesterday, realizing that I have to stock up for my family, you know, seeing the signs that say, you know, one milk carton per person, and then worrying about how to feed my family and feeling very strange about, you know, what felt like hoarding, stockpiling for a potential lockdown, and thinking to myself, this is terrible because it's essentially first come, first served, survival of the fittest attitude. And at a time like this, I would not at all mind a government that decided to ration food and said, don't worry, you will have enough. Take, you know, we're going to give you what you need, and you don't have to worry about whether there will be food next week or the week after that or the week after that, because we're going to ensure everybody has what they need. Instead, people are grabbing what they can because that's the country we live in.
Well, you know, last year in 2019, the U.S. Federal Reserve did a survey of savings in the United States. And what they found, I think, is chilling. They said that 40% of the U.S. population has $400 or less in their bank account. You know, when people are talking about hoarding, you have to remember that at least 40% of the population don't have the means to hoard. And it's at this time that the government should come in and provide a floor under people's anxieties. You know, that's what a government is for. That's
what Trump wants to give. Trump wants to give everybody $1,000. It's so strange to see some Democrats actually going to the right of that and saying, well, let's make it 500 and let's have means testing. I mean, amazing that even the Republican leaders is going further than the Democrats.
I mean, I think $1,000 is a very important gesture per person. Obviously, it's insufficient. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there should be a moratorium on rents, a moratorium on, you know, mortgage payments. There needs to be an entire slate of things that happen. People are not going to be able to afford their rents if they're not working and so on. But $1,000 is a very good beginning. You know, make it $2,000. And why means test it? What's the point? You know, if somebody needs the money, they need it. You know, otherwise you're going to have a catastrophic system where a whole bureaucracy is going to come in. This is an emergency. Hand over the money. Tell people with means, donate it to their food bank or refuse to cash the check. I mean, there are different ways to do it. Don't bureaucratize this in the middle of an emergency.
Right. And it's quite remarkable to see how people are actually coming together in love and solidarity, despite despite the messages that our government sends. In the end, it is a very human response to look out for one's neighbor. And let's hope that that extends to our international neighbors as well, such as countries like Iran and Venezuela. Vijay, thanks as always for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sonali.
My guest has been Vijay Prashad. He is the director of the Tri-Continental Institute for Social Research and a writing fellow and chief correspondent for Globetrotter, a project of the Independent Media Institute. We've been discussing sanctions on Venezuela, on Iran, and of course the coronavirus as it continues to spread around the country and the world. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Visit our website where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.